Let's turn to the Word in prayer. We're on 1 Peter chapter 2. You can look in your bulletin, or you can read along with me. 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning with verse 11. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. It was in God's providence, of course, everything's in God's providence, but it was a convenient providence that Mike and Susan were going to come up here today, because it gives me a chance to tell you why I'm not a missionary. The long and the short of it is I'm bad at it. I'm a bad traveler. I have done some, I've done two mission trips, and I think I can resolutely say they're two of the worst weeks I've had as far as just kind of physicalness. The last trip I had was in Peru. It was in Cusco, and when you land in Cusco, Peru, you land at an altitude of about 12,000 feet. That's where you land. That's the low point. That's twice Denver, and I get headaches in Denver. So you're walking through the airport, and one of the first things you see is this room full of oxygen tents. And that's for people who just can't take it. They can't get enough oxygen in their lungs at that altitude. They put them in an oxygen tent until the next plane out, and they put them on the next plane out. And I'll be honest with you, as I saw those, I thought about it. I made the wrong decision and stayed. I went through about 36 hours of altitude sickness, felt just awful, could not get out of bed, and that was the high point of the trip. I dehydrated. My clothes got lost. My luggage got lost by the airlines, which was actually my fault. And the students began saying, they summarized the trip by saying this: Ricky's clothes arrived on Wednesday, and his brain arrived on Friday. I just couldn't think. I wasn't present with everybody. To make things worse, the accommodations weren't exactly the Marriott spa. The kitchen smelled like decaying onions because it was filled with decaying onions, and that kind of made everything, including the water, taste a little bit like onions. And the shower, these were luxury accommodations. We had a hot shower. The water was heated by something called a widow maker. What happens was you had this trickle of water that would come over a little electric current that would heat the water as it poured over it. You can probably guess the reason why it was called a widow maker was because if you're standing in water and you touch the current, you would die. And so, but we did have warm trickles of water coming down our backs, and I was glad to get home. But you know, the funny thing is this: the trip was miserable, but we had funny stories about it. And I'm glad I did it. And we had two students go back and spend the whole summer in that place. And a lot of students get a vision for missions and go into the ministry from it. It was a valuable, valuable time, even though it was miserable. But, you know, it was okay that it was miserable, because we weren't there permanently, because that place wasn't home. And because we weren't there to be comforted, we weren't there to be served, we were there to help other people. We were there to serve. The Apostle Peter tells us that our stay here in this temporary place we call earth is much the same. As a church, as God's people, we are resident aliens. We are not from here. And the purpose of our time here is not for us to comfort ourselves and turn, kind of force the world into a comfortable place for us. The purpose of our time here is to serve, is to to serve the culture around us. Our primary citizenship is in heaven. What Peter says to us, we studied last week, that you are a chosen race. You are a new people. You're God's people. And he says, therefore, if you're a Christian, the most important thing about you is not that you're an American, or not that you're a Southerner, or not that you are a Jones or a Bradford or a Hall or whatever you are. The most important thing about you is that you are a Christian, that you are in Christ. Though we reside in the world, we're completely different from the world. And we live to serve this world that we find so different. That's Peter's point for us today. We live in this world, but we're not one of them. We're resident, we're aliens, we are sojourners. I said it wrong. Sojourners. Dang it. Practiced all night. We're sojourners. We're exiles. We live here, but we're not from here. That's the way Christians in the early world were thought. There was a Roman historian named Suetonius. I probably said that wrong too, but you don't know how that one's supposed to be said. Suetonius said that Christians were a class of people animated by a novel and mischievous disposition. He said that Christians weren't even humans. They are a new genus, a new species. They don't fit any category. And he said that for 10 reasons. He said these Christians disapprove of the violent, bloody games, the gladiatorial games. They disapprove of Caesar's wars of conquest. They disapprove of abortion and infanticide. They empower women. Women in the churches were given roles and given things to do, and they were treated as equals. These Christians believed in absolute truth. That wasn't common in that culture. Everything was true, and you could believe, you could follow Hippocrates or someone else, thinking that the truth is always changing. They believed that Jesus was the only true God and the only way of heaven. Nobody in that culture thought that. Everybody had their own temple, and it was okay as long as you went to a temple, it was good. But to say that this is the only way to heaven was ridiculous, uncalled for, unexpected. Christians mixed classes and races. That was terribly scandalous. You would have Greeks and Romans and Africans and barbarians together in the same room, eating at the same table. You would have slaves and nobility sitting at the same table. It was scandalous. Christians had radical plans to help the poor. Actually helped the poor instead of ushering them into slavery. Christians disapproved of premarital sex, or extramarital sex, which was unheard of in a culture where you worshipped Aphrodite and other goddesses by having sex with the prostitutes in the temple. And Christians disapproved of homosexuality, which was just a standard mark of rite of passage in the Greek world especially. I think about that list. It's not Roman. There's no conquest. There's no indulgence of the flesh. It's not Greek. There's no indulgence of the arrogant mind. It didn't fit. And Suetonius said, they're not humans if they're like that. They don't fit any category we know. The interesting thing is, I think that's a pretty accurate description of what Christians ought to be like. Can you think of any other list that doesn't fit? Lists that are very important for us today? Is this a liberal list? Some of these things are liberal. They don't approve of violent games, don't approve of wars of conquest, elevate women, help the poor. Some of them are pretty liberal. But some of them are pretty conservative. Disapprove of abortion, disapprove of sexual immorality, believe in absolute truth, believe that Jesus is the only way to heaven. What is it? Is this a liberal list or a conservative list? I need to know, what kind of church am I in today? What flavor are you? It doesn't fit, does it? And Peter tells us, and what's true 2,000 years ago is still true today. Christians, true biblical Christians, are a nation set apart, a different race and world within the world. And if we're able to understand our role in this world we have to keep a difficult tension. And it's a tension that's been lost both by the liberal and the conservative churches. We are to be in the world. Jesus says this in John 17. His believers are to be in the world, but not of the world. And he's left us in the world so that through us, the world could believe in him. We're in it. We live here amongst these people, but we're not like them. And yet, we're not like them in a way, not in a way that's in opposition, but we serve the world. Peter uses simpler words. He says that we're resident aliens who are here to show people, to proclaim the excellencies of him who has brought us out of the darkness into his marvelous light. We're here for the world, but we're not like them. Now, how liberal churches and conservative churches have really failed in this. In about 1926, actually, if you want to know the exact date, 1926, is when the liberal conservative church split, and the liberal and fundamentalist, and both of them took half of these truths. And ever since then, honestly, we've done a poor job in maintaining this tension. The liberal church has done a good job of being for the world. They serve the world. They are in the world. They want to help the poor. They want to maintain a good relationship with the world. The problem is they've become worldly. And once you lose your distinctions, you're not calling people into the marvelous light. You're just kind of in the darkness with them. The conservative church has done a good job of maintaining its distinctions. We're not like you. We don't believe what you believe. We're not immoral like you are. The problem is the conservative church has set themselves up to be the world's enemy. We're not here to serve you. We think you're bad and we want to defeat you and in order to establish kind of a cultural supremacy. This illustration was driven home to me. This point was driven home to me when I was at Mississippi State. I was a campus minister there, and the president of the Gay Student Association came to me to ask if he could come to RUF. That's very interesting to me. Here's a homosexual, a very upfront, out there guy. Everybody on the campus knew he was the homosexual who stood up for all homosexuals on the campus. He was in the newspaper every other week. And he's asking me if he could come to RUF. Why was he asking me? Well, he wanted to know something about Jesus. He thought there was something missing. And yet, he didn't trust me. He didn't trust us. He wondered, are they part of that war against culture? Am I the enemy to these people? And I did my best. You know, I said, you'll be warmly welcomed. I would love you to come. I will walk you in. But I'm going to tell you the exact same thing I'm going to tell everyone else. Unrepentant sexual sin, unrepentant sin of any sort will destroy you. We want that to be our message. On one hand, we need to be able to go to the homosexual and say, you're no worse than anybody else. We have to throw away the conservative agenda that sees these people as enemies, that we're fighting with these people for our culture or for our country. We have to throw that away. They're not the enemy. Their sin is the enemy. They are what we're fighting for. We're fighting for them to rescue them from their sin. So we have to throw away this mindset that says the homosexual is the enemy. On the same token, we have to throw away the liberal mindset that says the homosexual is our friend and there's nothing wrong with him. And the culture that is intolerant is the enemy. We have to maintain the distinction that sin is bad. It's going to destroy you. We have to maintain both. And that's hard. It's hard because we're afraid. We're afraid that if we maintain our distinctions, we're going to be shunned from the culture. We want to be like everybody else so they will like us. I am having a hard time preaching this sermon because I want you to like me. We want to be like everybody else so they'll like us. At the same time, we're afraid that we're going to lose our culture. We're going to lose America if we don't fight these people. And we're afraid that we're going to lose something valuable. And I want you to know, I think Peter comes to us in this text and he puts his arm around us and he invites us to something better. And he says, I know you're afraid. And I know this world disappoints you. But I want you to know you have so much more. This world is not your home. Home is so much better. And at home, you will be welcomed. And you will be secure and nothing's going to be taken away from you. God calls us to be resident alien servants. Resident, we live here. Alien, we're not like this place. Servants, we are for this place. And he tells us, as we imitate Christ, we unveil to the watching world the glory of Christ. So the first point, we're resident aliens, we're different. He says, beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which war against your soul. What does he say? He says, abstain from the passions of the flesh. You've got to be different from the world. And it frustrates us when the world gets us wrong, doesn't it? It frustrates us when the world thinks, when non-believers, let me use more specific language, when non-believers think of the church as self-righteous or judgmental. That's frustrating, isn't it? They're taking us wrong. I hate being taken wrong. You know who hates being taken wrong? Brandon Spikes. You know who Brandon Spikes is? Brandon Spikes is the middle linebacker and the team captain for the Florida Gators defense. And poor Brandon got caught on film gouging a guy's eyes against the Georgia Bulldogs. And it just tore him up. And the coach suspended him for one half of the game. And he said, no, suspend me for the whole game. And they interviewed him. And he told the press, he said, I just don't want to be known as the kind of guy who gouges eyes. And I just want to say, well, I got one piece of advice for you, Brandon. If you don't want to be known for gouging eyes, stop gouging eyes. Most of the people I know are not known for gouging eyes. And I think Brandon would look at the church and he'd say, well, Christians, you don't want to be known as self-righteous and judgmental? I got one piece of advice for you. Don't be self-righteous and judgmental. Stop judging everybody who's different from you. Stop sniggering and looking down on everybody who disagrees with you. You want to have a ministry? You've got to be holy. We can't control our sin. We have to repent of it. We have to turn away from our fleshly passions. Now, on one hand, the word fleshly passions is so confusing because immediately you all think pornography and food, right? Okay, they are fleshly passions. And I don't know, Saturdays are weird days for me. Saturdays when I spend at home, an unbiased observer would assume that my purpose on Saturday is to eat until I explode. Just kind of the human vacuum cleaner. If it's in the house, it's meant for me to eat. And yes, I just had a meal 7 minutes ago, but I'm hungry again. I'd rather you not ask me about it. And that's a fleshly passion, right? To fill whatever it is we want right now, we go fill it. We indulge the flesh, whether it be with rest, whether it be with entertainment, whether it be with food, whether it be with sex. We want to feel good now. We want to indulge the flesh. And yes, that is a fleshly passion. But let me ask you this. If I said no to all food because I want to be in shape, I want to look better than this one day, would I say every morning? Every morning. Is that a fleshly passion? Yes. The desire to look better in a mirror is a fleshly passion. If you don't get out of bed in the morning, are you indulging a fleshly passion? Yes, you're indulging sleep. You're being lazy. If you get out of bed in the morning to go and work and to prove to the world that you're a valuable human being, are you indulging a fleshly passion? Yes. You're indulging the passion to feel good about yourself, to be respectable. They're everywhere. And Satan does not care which one you indulge. There's a bad movie that illustrates this well. It's a bad movie. You cannot go and watch it on my authority. I want you to know that. But it's called, but I'll tell you the name of it. It's called The Devil's Advocate, and it's got Keanu Reeves and the guy who's in The Godfather, Al Pacino, who is Satan in this movie. And it's great because in the movie, Keanu Reeves is a lawyer. He starts the movie out by defending this sexual predator, a terrible human being who is guilty. And Keanu Reeves goes into the bathroom and he stares in that mirror and says, do you really want to do this? And he goes out and he gets the guy acquitted. And he's immediately thrust into notoriety. And he's snatched up by this wealthy law firm by, of course, Satan. And he becomes Satan's lawyer. And he compromises every possible moral. And he indulges every fleshly passion. And he ends up being just a terrible human and losing his soul. And at the end of the movie, it snaps back and he's back in that bathroom. And he's decided, no, I'm not going to do it. And so he goes back out into the courtroom and he recuses himself because he knows this person is guilty and he's going to lose his license to practice law. And now all the televisions are around him because he's so moral. And Satan is one of the reporters. And the last scene is he stares at the camera and he says, I don't care which path you choose. You can go the path of immorality or you can go the path of morality. But as long as you're doing it for yourself, and not out of an obedience and a love for Jesus, I've still got you. Abstain from fleshly passions. And I want to talk to you. I talk to people who indulge in some fleshly passions all the time. The folks who are looking at pornography and they want to stop, they come to me and I want to encourage you. Keep coming to me and I want to continue helping you. But the problem is people who have the fleshly passions of being workaholics, you say you understand the problem. But do you really believe what Peter says when he says, abstain from earthly passions for they that war against your soul? You see, if you've got the sins of righteousness, it's easy to believe you're doing fine. And I want you to know you are losing your soul. You amount to more than how you look in a mirror. You amount to more than your productivity. You amount to more than that. And if you can't take time off from work long enough to acknowledge that, your busyness will keep you from ever developing your soul. You can't be busy and find God in the quiet places of your heart at the same time. The Lord commands rest because He is the God who is found in times of rest. It takes time to feed a relationship with Him. It takes time. You cannot buy the 30-second-a-day Bible. Just like you can't do the 3-minute ab workout and have the washboard abs, you can't buy the 30-second-a-day Bible and have a meaningful, deep relationship with the Lord that fills your soul. It takes time. It takes time. We abstain from what wars against our soul and we do good. He says, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Keep your conduct honorable. It's confusing. It probably means something along the lines of make your conduct attractive. Be beautiful. Live the kind of life that people are going to look at and be attracted to that. They're going to want that. They're going to see people who are filled and complete and want to be like that. Ultimately, these people will glorify God if they see that. There's a power in an example. Tony Campolo was speaking on traditional marital roles once at a very liberal, small feminist all-women university, and he couldn't make no headway. And he used his final chance to address the crowd to just tell a story of his mom and his dad. And he just talked about how his dad married his mom when she was very young, and he took care of her, and he provided for her, and yes, she submitted to him, and she followed him. And ultimately, they stayed married about 60 years, and she died. And he and his brothers took their dad out to the front porch, and they talked to him about heaven, and they cried with him for a long time, and they talked to him about heaven a little more, and he said, boys, I'm glad your mom died first. He said, why? She goes, he said, I never want her. I'm glad she will never have to know this kind of pain. And that story quieted the crowd that hated him. And he had people coming up to him saying, I want that kind of relationship, but I don't trust men to give it to me. An example of beauty that quiets the mouth. That's what Peter is talking about. This idea of glorifying God in the day of visitation, it could mean one of two things. It could mean that the unbeliever is going to see your good works and be converted. And it might just mean that the unbeliever's mouth will be stopped on the day when God appears and there will be no more lying. The unbeliever will have to say, yes, that life was better. I should have lived it. We are called to be different from the world, holy, not indulging our flesh, not using our freedom to do whatever we want, to be different from the world. We can't follow the path that the liberal church has followed and give in to whatever the world has said was right that week. But we're also called to be servants of the world. Peter says our position is to be a servant, not a ruler. In order to serve the world, we have to be different from it, but we can't hate it either. We can't seek to destroy the world. Conservatives have been good at maintaining our distinctions from the world, but we've been bad at serving the culture. We've communicated that we hate the culture. And unbelievers have gotten that message. Our talk of a spiritual war, of a cultural war, we're not the only people who hear that. Unbelievers do believe that they are the enemy of the church. They really do. Why would an unbeliever come to me and ask permission to come to RUF? Nobody else asked permission. You know, the fraternity guys who are indulging every fleshly passion never asked me for permission to come, and everybody knew their sins were public, just as public as his homosexuals. Why was he the one who asked for permission? Because he was the one who was ostracized for his sin. We hate and vilify the culture most in the political arena. There's this desire for power, and the conservatives want to consolidate power and eradicate the culture and establish a theocracy, a godly government. And you have to know that's an old desire. That was around when Jesus was walking the earth. They were called the Zealots. They wanted to overthrow Rome, and they were mad at Jesus for not joining in with that. And Peter told these Zealots to submit to Rome. Listen to what he says. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. Now, let's think about that for a second. The last time Jesus saw Peter that we know of, he was fishing. And Jesus made Peter some breakfast, and Peter came, and they were restored to each other. They were reconciled. And the last thing Jesus said to Peter was, follow me. He said, Peter, when you were young, you went wherever you wanted to go. But when you're old, you're going to stretch out your hands, and you're going to be carried to a place you do not want to go. And he knew what that meant. He knew that he was going to be crucified. Every day of his life from that point on, he knew that he would be crucified. Every time he saw a Roman crucified, we all know that we're going to die. None of us are going to be crucified. It's a big deal to be hung from your hands and feet and left to die over many hours. And every time he saw a Roman soldier, he had to wonder, I wonder if it's going to be him. Are you the one that's going to kill me? Every day. And he knew that his death would have to come from Rome. Even the Jews say in John 18, Pilate says, you want to kill Jesus? You go kill him. And the Jews said, no, only the Romans can execute. And Peter said, not just obey the emperor, honor the emperor. And we think, well, I'm not going to honor an immoral president. You can't get more immoral than someone who kills Christians for fun. Honor the emperor. Why does he say we should submit? He says, for God's sake. He says, we display the glory of God by willingly submitting to our rulers. God has put them in place. And God will do his work through them. When Jesus is before Pontius Pilate, Pilate says, why are you not talking to me? Why are you not defending yourself? Don't you know I can have you put to death? And Jesus said, no, you couldn't. Not unless I wanted you to. You would have no authority unless my Father in heaven had given it to you. Do you still believe that's true? Think about this for a moment. If you were an unbeliever, non-Christian, outside the circle of Christianity, and you saw Christians wringing their hands because they had lost an election, would you be attracted to serve that God? I mean, what good is a God that can't win an election? Good heavens. But Peter knows there is no power except for that comes from God. Peter reminds us that the rulers are in place that God wants in place. Now, that doesn't mean that God's always doing something that we think is good. God wanted Jesus executed in a certain way. He told us about it all the way back in the Psalms. Jesus was going to be stretched out, nailed to a tree, left to die there. He says in Deuteronomy, cursed is anyone who dies on a tree. He told us how Jesus was going to die. In order to do that, he had to raise up a government that would do that. An evil government. And God used evil hands to serve righteous purposes. And Peter knew that God was still doing that. When the Jews started persecuting Christians in Jerusalem, what happened? The Christians left Jerusalem, and what did they do? They preached the gospel to other cities. And when Nero started persecuting Christians in Rome, what happened? The Christians left Rome. And they started preaching the gospel to other cities. And when Arius started spreading his lies of heresy in the Christian church in 300 AD, and they had to, and the people who believed in the Trinity were the minority, and they were sent out, what did they do? They preached the gospel to the barbarians. And when the Roman church became an evil thing and started persecuting those who believed the gospel, what happened? Christians went out and started preaching the gospel in unsafe places. And over and over and over again, we see God accomplishing a great and a glorious purpose through evil rulers and leaders. And Peter says, guess what? Your king's not up for election. Your king's never lost an election. And he's not going to run anytime soon. And whoever wins only will serve him. And I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means. But we're going to honor and we're going to serve the rulers God has put in place like we are serving God because we trust him. Because we trust him. I don't know. I'm talking to you, I'm as firmly entrenched to this as I could possibly be. When President Clinton was in office, I spent 6 hours a day listening to Rush Limbaugh and the Black Avenger. I mean, the only internet sites I ever surfed were just right-wing conspiracy websites, and I was convinced he was the spawn of Satan. And it was sin. It was sin. It was distrust of Jesus. And it was wrong. And I'm convinced now that whatever President Obama does, whatever he does, he will do it to the benefit of my country. He's going to do whatever he does to the benefit of my home because my country is God's kingdom and we're not going to lose. We are not going to lose. And President Obama is his servant whether he knows it or not. So what does submitting mean? We submit, he says, honor the emperor. Submit by honoring the emperor. Now, if you're a parent, you know what that means. It's the same thing God tells your kids to do to you. So, whatever you want from your children, you go give that to your president. You know, do you want your children to agree with every decision you make? Probably not. Do you want them to go off into the room and talk bad about you and spread lies about you to their friends? No, actually not. Do you want them to call you an idiot behind your back? No, actually I don't. I want them to honor me. And if you want a great avenue to worship in this, I'm sorry, if you want a great avenue to do evangelism in this, the reddest state in the union, when your friends start talking about how stupid President Obama is, tell them you support the president. And when she says, why? Say, because you love Jesus. And when she says, but he's doing evil things that are against Jesus, and you say, not unless Jesus wanted him to, he wouldn't. Emperor Caesar did evil things against Jesus too, and it ended up bringing the salvation of the world. And I trust what God is doing. I do not trust what President Obama is doing. I trust what God is doing. What does that mean? Does it mean you sit idly by and watch things you care about go to the pot? No. You need to vote every time they let you. And that's tempting for me because my name is Ricky Jones. And I could vote in every precinct in this state. And they're not going to ask for an address, so I could. I really thought about it the last time. I was just like, just for fun, let's just see how many times I can vote. But not wanting to go to jail, I didn't. Vote every time they let you. Denounce evil every time they see it. But do it in a way that communicates respect and compassion. Remember, our desire is not to defeat those with whom we disagree. It is their conversion. It is their conversion. And finally, and I'll get off this forever and ever, and I've never wanted to preach a sermon less. I want you to know this. The glory of America, the United States of America's glory will fade. Just like Persia's glory faded. Just like Babylon's glory faded. Just like Greece's glory faded, just like Rome's glory faded, just like Europe's glory's faded, just like Britain's glory's faded, the United States of America's glory will fade. God is not interested in establishing the kingdom of God by the military might of the United States of America. He won't do it that way. And I don't know what that means, and I don't know how, and I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet. I can tell you some things I hope it means. I honestly hope it means we get overrun with illegal aliens. And I say that because if you'll go back to the beginning of the story, remember, I don't like to visit third world countries. And I would love to preach the gospel to some third world people without having to leave Tulsa. That would be cool. That's about the only way I'm going to do it. And it's going to mean that the homosexual group becomes more and more accepted in culture. And that's a good thing because I want to preach the gospel to homosexuals, and I can't do that if they're going to deny that they're gay. We've got to get their sin out in the open before we can ever even talk about it. I don't know what it means. Whatever. Let's not go down there. But it does. I do know that God's going to win. And I know that one day we're going to sit around with all those who've been converted and say the nations of this world have become the nations of our Lord and of His Christ. And He will reign forever and ever and ever. And that day has already started and it will not end. It will not end. And we can get a glorious sense of the peace to let our culture go and by remembering that we're not home. And this culture is not our inner ring. It's not our group. It's not our family. We're part of a much more precious inner ring. I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase inner ring. It's something that C.S. Lewis wrote about. He says, whenever a child grows up and sees his mom and his dad hugging, you want to be part of that hug. And as you grow, and the older you get, the more you keep kind of seeing these rings you want to be a part of. And you go to school and you hear people laughing about a joke and you start laughing before you even know what the joke is because you want to be in. And you see people sitting at a table and you want to go sit at that table. And you see people talking about a sports team and you want to make them your favorite sports team because you want to be in. And it never really goes away. And you go get older and you go to college and hear people talking about a fraternity party. So you want to be in that fraternity because you want to be in. And you see people at work talking around the water cooler and you're not thirsty, but you go to the water cooler because you want to be in. And he says the reason for that is because we have this deep need within us to be part of the inner ring. And the reality is there is an inner ring. There really is. There was an inner ring of three. The Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And they loved each other. And they loved each other so much they wanted to make the ring bigger. And Jesus explains that he's in John 17 that he's going to die in order to bring us into that inner ring. And he says this, these are glorious words. He prays for us. He says, I've given them your word, and the world has hated them because they're not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them. As you sent me into the world, so I've sent them into the world. And for their sake, I consecrate myself that they may be sanctified in truth. Now listen to why he's doing this. He says, I want them all to be one, just as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us. So the world may believe that you sent me. Why is he doing it? Why does he set himself apart? Why does he die? To bring us into the inner ring. And when we're in that ring, we will not be disappointed. When you're in that ring, I want you to understand something. When you're in that ring, the person who knows you the best has not abandoned you. When you're in that ring, the person who knows you the best has not turned away from you and gone away to find someone else more attractive, has not exploited you, has not hurt you. When you're in that ring, you're in a ring where the person who knew you down to your toes loved you and died for you. And when you're in that ring, you're secure enough to let all the other rings go. Please pray with me.